Chapter 1. Herod's Predecessors. At the time when Antiochus Epiphanes was disputing the control of Palestine with Ptolemy VI, dissension broke out among the leading Jews, who competed for supremacy because no prominent person could bear to be subject to his equals. Onias, one of the chief priests, forced his way to the top and expelled from the city the sons of Tobias. They fled to Antiochus and implored him to use them as guides and invade Judea. This was just what the king wanted. So, setting out in person with a very large force, he stormed the city, killed a large number of Ptolemy's adherents, gave his men permission to loot as they liked, took the lead in plundering the sanctuary, and stopped the continuous succession of daily sacrifices for 3.5 years. The high priest Onias fled to Ptolemy, from whom he obtained a site in the district of Heliopolis. There he built a little town on the lines of Jerusalem and a sanctuary like the one he had left. All this will be referred to again in due course. Antiochus was far from satisfied with his unexpected capture of the city, the loot, and the long death roll. Unable to control his passions and remembering what the siege had cost him, he forced the Jews to break their ancient law by leaving their babies uncircumcised and sacrificing swine on the altar. Meeting with a blank refusal, he executed the leading recusants, and Bacchides, who was sent by him to command the garrison, finding in these monstrous instructions scope for his savage instincts, plunged recklessly into every form of iniquity, torturing the most worthy citizens one by one, and publicly displaying day after day the appearance of a captured city, till by the enormity of his crimes he drove his victims to attempt reprisals. Matthias, son of Asamoneus, a priest from the village of Modine, raised a tiny force consisting of his 5 sons and himself, and killed Bacchides with cleavers. Fearing the strength of the garrison, he fled to the hills for the time being. But when many of the common people joined him, he regained confidence, came down again, gave battle, defeated Antiochus's generals, and chased them out of Judea. By that success he achieved supremacy, and in gratitude for his expulsion of the foreigners, his countrymen gladly accepted his rule, which on his decease he left to Judas, the eldest of his sons. As Judas did not expect Antiochus to take this lying down, he not only marshaled the available Jewish forces, but took the bold step of allying himself with Rome. When Epiphanes again invaded the country, he counterattacked vigorously and drove him back. Then, striking while the iron was hot, he hurled himself against the garrison of the city, which had not yet been dislodged, threw the troops out of the upper city, and shut them into the lower, the part of the town called the citadel. Then, taking possession of the temple, he cleansed the whole area and walled it round, ordered a new set of ceremonial vessels to be fashioned and brought into the sanctuary as the old ones were defiled, built another altar, and resumed the sacrifices. No sooner was Jerusalem once more the holy city than Antiochus died, leaving as heir both to his throne and to his hatred of the Jews his son Antiochus. The new king got together 50,000 foot, about 500 horse and 80 elephants, and marched through Judea into the hill country. Bethsaron, a small town, fell into his hands, but at a place called Beth-Zachariah, where the road narrows, he was met by Judas and his army. Before the main bodies engaged, Eleazar, Judas's brother, noticed the tallest of the elephants fitted with a large howdah and gilded battlements, and, assuming that Antiochus was on its back, ran out a long way ahead of his own lines, and hacking away through the enemy's close array, got near to the elephant, To reach the supposed king was impossible because of his height from the ground. So he struck the beast's underbelly, bringing it down on himself, so that he was crushed to death. He had done no more than make a heroic attempt, putting glory before life itself. The rider of the elephant was, in fact, a commoner. Even if he had happened to be Antiochus, Eleazar would have achieved nothing by his daring but the reputation of having, in the mere hope of a brilliant success, gone to certain death. To his brother, the tragedy was a presage of the final issue. Determined and prolonged as was the Jews' resistance, superior numbers and fortune's favour gave the king's soldiers the victory. Most of his own men dead, Judas fled with the remnant to the toparchy of Gophna. Antiochus went on to Jerusalem, where he remained only a few days, till lack of supplies compelled him to withdraw, leaving a garrison that he thought adequate, and taking the rest of his forces to winter quarters in Syria. After the king's retreat, Judas did not let the grass grow under his feet. Large numbers of Jews flocked to his standard, and he had already rallied the survivors of the battle. So, near the village of Akadasa, he challenged Antiochus's generals. In the battle that followed, he fought magnificently and inflicted heavy casualties on the enemy, but lost his own life. Only a few days later, his brother John fell victim to a plot of the pro-Syrian party. John was succeeded by another brother, Jonathan, who did everything possible to strengthen his authority in his own country, securing his position by his friendship with Rome and by making a truce with Antiochus's son. Unfortunately, none of these precautions could guarantee him security. Trypho, guardian of the young Antiochus and virtually regent, had long been plotting against the boy and endeavouring to eliminate his friends, and when Jonathan came with a very small escort to Ptolemais to see Antiochus, he treacherously seized and imprisoned him and launched a campaign against the Jews. Then repulsed by Simon, Jonathan's brother, he avenged his defeat by murdering Jonathan. Simon's conduct of affairs was most efficient. He reduced Gazara, Joppa, and Jamnia in the neighbourhood of Jerusalem, and demolished the citadel after overwhelming the garrison. Later he allied himself with Antiochus against Trypho, whom Antiochus was besieging in Dora before marching against the Parthians. But he did not cause the king to modify his ambitions by helping him to destroy Trypho. It was not long before Antiochus sent an army under his general Cendebeus to ravage Judea and reduce Simon to subjection. Simon, in spite of his years, showed a young man's vigour in his conduct of the campaign. He sent his sons ahead with his stoutest men, while he himself, at the head of a section of his army, took the offensive in another direction. He also placed large numbers of men in ambush all over the hill country, and was successful in every onset. So brilliant was his victory that he was appointed high priest, and after 170 years of Macedonian control, gave the Jews their freedom. He too was the victim of a plot. He was assassinated at a banquet by Ptolemy, his son-in-law, who, after locking up Simon's wife and two of his sons, sent a party to murder the third son, John Hyrcanus. Warned of their approach, the youngest made a dash for the city, having great confidence in the people, who remembered what his father had achieved and were disgusted by Ptolemy's iniquitous conduct. Ptolemy hurled himself against another gate, but was thrown back by the citizens, who had already welcomed Hyrcanus with open arms. Ptolemy at once retired to one of the forts above Jericho, called Dagon. Hyrcanus, invested with the high priesthood like his father before him, offered sacrifice to God, and then hurried after Ptolemy to rescue his mother and brothers. His attack on the fort started promisingly enough, but was held up by his natural feelings. Every time Ptolemy was in a difficulty, he brought out John's mother and brothers onto the ramparts where they could be seen by all, and began to torture them, threatening to throw them headlong unless John broke off with the siege forthwith. This atrocity filled Hyrcanus with anger, and still more with pity and fear. But neither torture nor the threat of death could make his mother flinch. She stretched out her arms and implored her son on no account to let her cruel sufferings induce him to spare the vile creature. Better death at Ptolemy's hands than life without end, so long as he paid for his wrongs to their house. Whenever John, thrilled by his mother's fortitude, listened to her entreaties, he launched a fresh attack. But when he saw her flesh torn with the lash, his resolution weakened, and his feelings overcame him. This dragged out the siege till the year of rest came round, for, like the seventh day, the seventh year is observed by the Jews as a time of rest. This freed Ptolemy from the siege, and after putting John's mother and brothers to death, he fled to Zeno Cotulus, the autocrat of Philadelphia. Antiochus, eager to avenge his defeat at Simon's hands, marched into Judea, and pitching his camp before Jerusalem, besieged Hyrcanus. Hyrcanus opened the tomb of David, the wealthiest of kings, and removed more than 3,000 talents. With a tenth of this sum he bribed Antiochus to raise the siege. With the balance he did what no Jew had ever done before. He maintained a body of mercenaries. When, later, Antiochus marched against the Parthians, giving him a chance to retaliate, he at once launched a campaign against the towns of northern Palestine, correctly assuming that he would find no first-class troops in them. Medebi and Gamia, with the towns nearby, submitted, as did Sichem and Gerizim. He was successful also against the Cutheans, the people living round the copy of the temple at Jerusalem. In Idumea, a number of towns submitted, including Dorion and Marissa. Advancing to Samaria, where now stands Sebaste, the city built by King Herod, he constructed a wall right round and entrusted the siege to his sons Aristobulus and Antigonus. They pressed it relentlessly, bringing the inhabitants so near to starvation that they resorted to the most unwanted food. They appealed for aid to Antiochus the Aspendian. He readily agreed, but was defeated by Aristobulus and his men. Chased by the brothers all the way to Scythopolis, he managed to escape. They, returning to Samaria, again shot the people inside the walls, then took the city, demolished it, and enslaved the inhabitants. As success followed success, they lost none of their ardor, but marching their forces as far as Scythopolis, overran that region and ravaged all the country inland from Mount Carmel. Jealousy of the continued success of John and his sons aroused the bitter hostility of their fellow countrymen, who gathered in large numbers and engaged in active opposition, which at last flared up in open war and ended in defeat. For the rest of his natural life, John enjoyed prosperity, and after no less than 33 years of admirable administration, he died, leaving 5 sons. Blessed if ever a man was, and with no cause to blame fortune as far as he was concerned. He alone enjoyed the 3 greatest privileges at once: political power, the high priesthood, and the prophetic gift. So constant was his divine inspiration that no future event was hidden from him. For instance, he foresaw and foretold that his 2 eldest sons would not retain control of the state. Their overthrow is a story worth telling, so far they fell below their predecessor's prosperity. When their father died, the eldest of them, Aristobulus, turned the constitution into a monarchy and was the first to wear a crown, 471 years, 3 months after the return of the nation to their own land, set free from slavery in Babylon. To the next brother, Antigonus, of whom he seemed very fond, he assigned equal honors. The rest he imprisoned in fetters. In fetters, too, he placed his mother, who contested his claim to supremacy, as John had left her in supreme charge, going so far in brutality as to let her die of starvation in the dungeon. Vengeance overtook him in the loss of his brother Antigonus, of whom he was so fond that he had made him sharer of his royal authority. He killed even him as the result of slanders invented by unscrupulous courtiers. At first their tales were disbelieved by Aristobulus, who, as we have said, was very fond of his brother, and put down most of their lies to jealousy. But when Antigonus returned with full ceremony from a campaign to attend the feast at which it is an old custom to put up tabernacles to God, it happened that Aristobulus was ill at the time. At the end of the feast, Antigonus went up to the temple with his bodyguard and in full regalia to offer prayers, mainly for his brother's recovery. Meanwhile, the unscrupulous courtiers went to the king and told him all about the escort of soldiers and the proud bearing of Antigonus, improper in a subject. He was coming, they said, with a huge force to murder him, unable to rest content with the shadow of royalty when he could grasp the substance. These tales, by degrees, overcame the reluctance of Aristobulus, who took care to hide his suspicions, but at the same time to guard against any unseen danger. While he himself was confined to bed in the fort, at first called Baris, and later Antonia, he stationed his bodyguard in one of the underground passages, with orders to leave Antigonus alone if unarmed, but to kill him if he came in arms. Then he sent men to warn his brother to come unarmed. To counter this, the queen contrived a very cunning plot with the conspirators. They bribed the messengers to suppress the king's warning and tell Antigonus that his brother had heard he had secured some wonderful armor and military equipment in Galilee. Owing to his unfortunate illness, he could not come and see them himself. However, he went on, now that you are just leaving, I should very much like to see you in your outfit. Hearing this, and aware of nothing in his brother's disposition to make him suspect any harm, Antigonus set off in his armor to have it inspected. When he came to the dark passage called Strato's Tower, the bodyguard killed him, convincing evidence that no natural affection is proof against slander, and that none of our better feelings are strong enough to hold out against envy indefinitely. The incident had another surprising feature. Judas was an Essene, born and bred, who had never been wrong or mistaken in any of his predictions. On this occasion, when he saw Antigonus passing through the temple, he called out to his acquaintances. A number of his pupils were sitting there with him. O God, the best thing now is that I should die, since truth is dead already, and one of my predictions has proved false. There, alive, is Antigonus, who was to have been killed today. The place where he was fated to die was Strato's Tower, and that is 70 miles away, and it is already 10 o'clock. The time has made nonsense of my prophecy. Having said this, the old man remained lost in gloomy thoughts, and a few minutes later came the news that Antigonus had been murdered in the underground strong point, which was actually called Strato's Tower, like the coastal town of Caesarea. So the prophet's mistake was natural. Aristobulus, bitterly regretting this foul crime, at once fell into a swift decline. At the thought of the murder, his mind became unhinged, and he wasted away, until his entrails were ruptured by his uncontrollable grief, and he brought up quantities of blood. While carrying this away, one of the servants waiting on him, impelled by divine providence, slipped at the very spot where Antigonus had been struck down, and, on the bloodstains, still visible, of the murdered man, he spilt the blood of the killer. At once a shriek went up from the spectators, as if the servant had poured the blood there on purpose. Hearing the cry, the king asked the reason, and when no one dared tell him, he insisted on being informed. At last, by threats, he compelled them to tell him the truth. His eyes filled with tears, and groaning with the little strength that was left, he murmured, "So it is. I could not hide my unlawful deeds from God's all-seeing eye. Swift retribution pursues me for the blood of my kinsmen. How long, most shameless body, will you contain the soul that has been adjudged my mother's and my brother's? How long shall I pour out my blood to them drop by drop? Let them take it all at once. Let heaven mock them no more with these libations from my entrails." The next moment he was dead, having reigned no more than a year. His widow released his brothers and enthroned Alexander, the eldest, and seemingly the most balanced character. But on ascending the throne, he executed one brother as a rival claimant. The survivor, who preferred to keep out of the public eye, he held in honor. He also came into conflict with Ptolemy Lathyrus, who had seized the town of Asocus. He inflicted many casualties, but Ptolemy had the advantage. But when Ptolemy was chased away by his mother Cleopatra and withdrew to Egypt, Alexander besieged and took Gadara and Amathus, the biggest stronghold east of the Jordan, where were stored the most valuable possessions of Zeno's son Theodorus. But by a sudden counterattack, Theodorus not only recovered his property, but captured the king's baggage train, killing some 10,000 Jews. However, the blow was not fatal, and Alexander, turning towards the coast, captured Gaza, Raphia, and Anthedon, which King Herod later renamed Agrippias. After his enslavement of these towns, there was a Jewish rising at one of the feasts, the usual occasion for sedition to flare up. It looked as if he would be unable to crush this conspiracy, but his foreign troops came to the rescue. These were Pisidians and Cilicians. Palestinians he did not recruit as mercenaries because of their innate detestation of all Jews. After putting to the sword over 6,000 of the insurgents, he attacked Arabia, overrunning Gilead and Moab, and imposing tribute on the inhabitants. Then returning to Amathus, he found that Theodorus had taken fright at his victories and abandoned the fortress. So he demolished it. He next took the field against Abodos of Arabia. But the king had laid an ambush near Gaulane, and Alexander fell into the trap, losing his entire army, which was crowded together at the bottom of a ravine and crushed by a mass of camels. He made good his own escape to Jerusalem, but the completeness of the disaster fanned the smoldering fires of hatred, and the nation rose in revolt, only to be worsted again in a succession of battles which lasted 6 years and cost the lives of as many as 50,000 Jews. He had little cause to rejoice over these victories, so ruinous to his kingdom. So, suspending warlike operations, he attempted to reach an understanding with his subjects by persuasion. But they were still more embittered by his change of front and unstable behavior. And when he asked in what way he could satisfy them, they replied, "By dying. Even a dead man would be hard to forgive for such monstrous crimes." Without more ado, they called on Demetrius the Ready for help. He at once agreed, in the hope of enlarging his kingdom, and arrived with an army, joining his Jewish allies near Sichem. The combined army was opposed by Alexander with 1,000 cavalry and an infantry force of 8,000 mercenaries, reinforced by loyal Jews to the number of 10,000. The other side consisted of 3,000 cavalry and 14,000 infantry. Before battle was joined, the two kings issued proclamations intended to detach supporters from the other side. Demetrius, hoping to win over Alexander's mercenaries, Alexander, Demetrius's Jewish contingent. As the Jews would not abandon their bitterness or the Greeks their loyalty, there was nothing for it but an appeal to force. Victor in the battle was Demetrius, in spite of a magnificent display of determination and prowess by Alexander's mercenaries. The outcome of the engagement, however, was not at all what either side had expected. Demetrius, the victor, was deserted by those who had called him in, whereas, through sympathy for the man who was down, Alexander, after fleeing to the hills, was joined by 6,000 Jews. This swing of the pendulum was too much for Demetrius. Convinced that Alexander was now fit to take the field again, and that the whole nation was flocking to his standard, he withdrew. The departure of their allies did not cause the rest of the people to lay aside their quarrel. They waged war unremittingly with Alexander till, after very heavy losses, the remnant were driven into Bemisilis. When this town fell, the survivors were taken as prisoners to Jerusalem. So unbridled was Alexander's rage that from brutality he proceeded to impiety. 800 of the prisoners he impaled in the middle of the city, then butchered their wives and children before their eyes. Meanwhile, cup in hand, as he reclined amidst his concubines, he enjoyed the spectacle. Such terror gripped the people that the next night 8,000 of the king's opponents fled right out of Judea, and remained in exile till his death. By such deeds he at last gave his kingdom an uneasy peace, and hung up his weapons. But fresh troubles were in store for him. The work of Antiochus Dionysius, brother of Demetrius, and last heir of Seleucus. This man launched a campaign against the Arabs, alarming Alexander, who dug a deep trench stretching from the hillside above Antipatris to the beach at Joppa, raising a high wall in front of the trench with wooden towers built into it to ward off attacks at the weak points. But Antiochus was not to be stopped. He burnt the towers, filled in the trench, and marched his army across. Deciding to deal later with the man who had tried to stop him, he went straight on to attack the Arabs. Their king retired to better defensive positions, then suddenly faced about with his cavalry force of 10,000 men and fell upon the army of Antiochus while in disarray. A bitter struggle followed. While Antiochus survived, his men fought on, though they suffered appallingly at Arab hands. When at last he fell, as a result of risking his life all the time in the forefront to help his struggling soldiers, the entire line broke. Most of his army was destroyed in the engagement, or in the subsequent flight. The survivors took refuge in the village of Cana, where lack of food killed off all but a handful. At this point, the people of Damascus, through hatred of Ptolemy, son of Menneus, brought in Aretas, and made him king of Coelia Syria. He promptly marched into Judea, defeated Alexander in battle, agreed on terms, and withdrew. Alexander took Pella and advanced against Gerasa, once more coveting Theodorus's possessions. After shutting up the garrison within a triple wall, he occupied the place without a battle. He went on to overwhelm Gaulani and Seleucia, and the valley of Antiochus's, and captured the strong fortress of Gamala, dismissing its commander Demetrius, who was accused of many crimes. Then he returned to Judea after 3 whole years in the field, and was warmly welcomed by the nation in view of his successes. But the end of the war proved to be the beginning of physical decay. Afflicted with a quartan ague, he thought he could get rid of his sickness by resuming a strenuous life. He threw himself into ill-judged campaigns, and by making impossible demands on his bodily strength, wore himself out completely. He died in the midst of storms and stress, after reigning 27 years. He had left his throne to his wife, Alexandra, confident that the Jews would most readily submit to her, since by her freedom from any trace of his brutality and her constant opposition to his excesses, she had gained the goodwill of the people. And he was right in his expectations. Woman though she was, She established her authority by her reputation for piety. She was most particular in her observance of the national customs, and offenders against the holy law she turned out of office. Of the two sons she had borne Alexander, she appointed the elder, Hyrcanus, high priest, in view of his age and his natural disinclination to interfere with state affairs. The younger, Aristobulus, who was an impulsive character, she kept out of the public eye. Alongside her was the growing power of the Pharisees, a Jewish sect that appeared more pious than the rest and stricter in the interpretation of the law. Alexandra, being devoted to religion, paid too great heed to them, and they, availing themselves more and more of the simplicity of the woman, ended by becoming the effective rulers of the state, free to banish or recall, to release or imprison at will. In short, the privileges of royal authority were theirs, the expenses and vexations Alexandra's. She was very shrewd in making major decisions, and by regularly recruiting, doubled the size of her army, collecting also a large mercenary force, so that beside making her own country strong, she inspired a healthy respect in foreign potentates. But while she ruled others, the Pharisees ruled her. Thus, Diogenes, an eminent man who had been a friend of Alexander, was put to death by them on the charge of having abetted the king in his impaling of 800 citizens. Then they pressed Alexandra to execute the rest of those who had incited Alexander against them. Her superstitious nature made her give way, and they killed whom they would. The most prominent of the threatened citizens sought the aid of Aristobulus, and he persuaded his mother to spare them in view of their station, expelling them from the city if not sure of their innocence. Thus granted impunity, they scattered over the country.